there's already been some big changes made, like the substation having video cameras, cameras in cars.
The Anchorage Police Department tightens protocols after an officer was convicted of sexual assault. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a second early fall storm bears down on Anchorage.
We're looking at gusts up to 100 miles an hour along the upper hillside, beginning sometime around midnight on Saturday night.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
A group of stakeholders in the Tongass National Forest have voted to support a proposed land exchange in southeast Alaska. The Tongass Futures Roundtable voted yesterday to support the land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The deal involves nearly 39,000 acres of federal and mental health trust lands. As proposed, the exchange includes about 20,900 acres of federal land in the Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island area and about 18,060 acres of mental health trust tracks around Ketchikan, Myers Chuck, Petersburg, Wrangell, Sitka, and Juneau. A Chinese heavy lift vessel brought the Endeavour jack-up drill rig to Ketchikan Bay from Singapore, but it appears the rig itself might have carried its own unique and unwanted cargo. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
Brian Smith of the Peninsula Clarion reports this week that officials with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are concerned about the possibility of invasive species arriving in Cook Inlet with the Endeavour jackup rig. Officials confirm Wednesday they've been communicating with the rig's owner, Buccaneer Energy, about what organisms might have still been attached to the rig when it was brought north August 24th. Homer resident Larry Smith toured the rig a few weeks ago and plucked a small shell he said appears to be a foreign oyster off of one of the rig's legs and brought it to the attention of the Ketchikan Bay Research Reserve staff. Smith says the shell was one of thousands in the area where he found it. Tammy Davis is a Juneau-based fish and game biologist who leads the department's invasive species program. She said the department offered to assist Buccaneer by taking samples of any organisms on the jackup rig and identifying them. In response, Buccaneer hired a private biologist from a consulting agency to do that task. Davis says Fish and Game has requested the results of those samples and biological analysis be forwarded them for further review. Buccaneer issued a statement late Wednesday through Jay Marakis of public relations firm JMR Worldwide, saying the company considered environmental safety a, quote, top priority, and it would, quote, never knowingly do anything to compromise it. Marakis says that initial findings show there is no issue with invasive species and that Buccaneer will issue the final results upon its completion. Davis said Fish and Game officials are still considering what it would do if the organism found were indeed an invasive species and could pose a threat to the environment. Fish and Game's upper management has been in contact with the state attorney general's office, she said, to find out what its authorities are. Davis said she isn't sure if any organisms attached to the rig could have survived the weeks they were out of the water in transport from Singapore. That would depend on the specific species. In an email to KBBI News and other media outlets last week, Marakis announced a dedication ceremony would take place aboard the Endeavour Monday evening at 6 p.m., but no cameras will be allowed on board, and certain parts of the rig would be off limits to reporters. Marakis said in the email, quote, Buccaneer wants to control the footage to make sure the photos are as nice as possible. Because of those restrictions, KBBI News will not be attending the dedication ceremony. We will, of course, continue to report on the activities of Buccaneer Energy and the Endeavour jackup rig. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
A report on official procedures in the wake of a sexual assault conviction of a former Anchorage police officer, Anthony Rollins, were made public today. Rollins was convicted of raping several women while he was an on-duty police officer. He has been sentenced, but the aftermath of his crimes has initiated changes in Anchorage Police Department procedures. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Anchorage city officials were briefed on the International Association of Chiefs of Police report at a work session Friday in Anchorage. Anchorage Police Department Chief Mark Mew says the report looked at what his department has done in the last year to make changes.
So it concentrated a lot on our internal affairs capacity, how we work, how we track information, how accessible we are to the public, how seriously we take these matters. There's a lot of data in there on that topic. We've done about 10 initiatives that we at the APD felt would make it very difficult for us to have another event of this type. The ICP looked at those and measured and told us whether or not they thought those were good ideas, and they did like them. They thought we had gone a long ways towards closing this door.
Mew says the IACP did make recommendations about additional staff training, documentation of the initiative's progress, and an annual assessment by a municipal auditor. The police chief was not certain about the additional costs of the programs.
It recommends we fill a couple of positions that have been unfilled for some time. And of course, we're looking at budget situation right now that may involve reductions in staff. So I don't know how that budget picture is going to form up yet. But potentially, you know, filling those two positions would cost money, and that money that may or may not be in my budget next year.
The IACP report mentioned that the APD had, quote, recognized the consequences of the Rollins event and its threat to the public trust, while the department has embraced a commitment to mitigate future acts of sexual misconduct, as well as the APD's zero-tolerance policy for sexual misconduct. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan says the report is an affirmation that under Mew's leadership, the city police department has improved its procedures. Although the report's recommendations may not be immediately implemented, Sullivan said.
No, it doesn't happen overnight, but we've already, just in the time since the Rollins incident happened, there's already been some big changes made, like the substation having video cameras, cameras in cars, the contact reports that we do where every contact with a citizen, they receive a card about who that officer was and how to reach them, random checks that we do to interview folks that have had contact with officers to make sure that contact was professional. So we've got an awful lot accomplished already, and again, more to do.
Mayor Sullivan said the $5.5 million the city must pay resulting from lawsuits stemming from the Rollins case will be shared by insurance and by city taxpayers. He says the cost to taxpayers will be about $2 million. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Another large windstorm is moving toward Anchorage and surrounding areas. The storm is across the southern Bering Sea currently, but is expected to hit south-central Alaska and particularly Anchorage late Saturday night. National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Hopkins says the storm will mainly hit three areas of the city, starting with the upper hillside.
We're looking at gusts up to 100 miles an hour along the upper hillside, beginning sometime around midnight on Saturday night. And those strongest winds should continue for about 12 hours up there. And then after the front passes around noontime or 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, those winds should drop down to, you know, about the gust to 80 mile an hour range. And those should persist for another 8 or 10 hours and begin to diminish sometime on Sunday night.
Hopkins says strong winds will affect the lower hillside and East Anchorage. Gusts could reach 70 miles an hour or higher. Those winds could begin Sunday morning and persist until early afternoon, with 45 mile an hour gusts forecast out until midnight Sunday. The third area to be hit will be West Anchorage and downtown.
By noontime, we expect them to be fairly strong, maybe gusting to 50, maybe 60 miles an hour, which is pretty good for West Anchorage. And that should be noontime Sunday to about midnight on Sunday.
Strong winds may hit the Mat-Su Valley, possibly up to 70 miles per hour gusts. And there may be strong winds on the Kenai, but the strongest winds are predicted for Anchorage. There is also heavy participation anticipated for the eastern Kenai Peninsula, North Gulf Coast, Valdez, Cordova, and Whittier. Scott Lindsay is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service River Forecast Office.
The amounts that we're seeing right now from Saturday to Sunday night, 24-hour period, are widespread 4 to 7 inches and bullseyes of 9-plus inches.
There is concern for urban streams in Seward, Valdez, and Cordova reaching bank-full levels or possibly over stream banks. A spokesman for Shell Alaska says it will be at least Monday before a company drillship can return to the offshore petroleum prospect in the Chukchi Sea. Curtis Smith says ice is still prevalent over the Royal Dutch Shell prospect, 70 miles off the coast of northwest Alaska. A Shell drill ship, the Noble Discoverer, on Sunday began preliminary work on an exploratory well. Ice measuring 30 miles long and 12 miles wide was spotted heading for the drillship, and Shell moved its vessel 30 miles south to wait for it to pass. Smith says the ice is expected to pass through in the next 2 days. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the 50th anniversary of a Fairbanks marathon.
Fairbanks was a pretty small town and there wasn't that much going on, so it became a big event that everyone wanted to participate in.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ensuring our youth understand the need for workplace safety will help prevent injuries. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
Anchorage police have charged 37-year-old Jason Barnum with three counts of attempted murder in the shooting of a police officer yesterday at the Merrill Field Inn. Barnum was arrested this morning after his release from an Anchorage hospital for treatment of a gunshot wound suffered in the shootout. The standoff with Barnum resulted in a non-life-threatening injury to one police officer while it shut down major traffic arteries in the city for about an hour. Police officers had gone to the motel to investigate a string of burglaries when Barnum began shooting at them. A SWAT team was called in and the motel was evacuated before Barnum surrendered. His arraignment was scheduled for this afternoon. The 50th running of the Equinox Marathon starts at 8 a.m. tomorrow at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A near record number of participants is expected. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Equinox Marathon is more than a running race. It's a culmination of summer, a gathering to celebrate the beauty of fall and impending winter. The race has a humble beginning in the early 1960s, but three-time Equinox champion and journalist Matthias Saari, who has a book coming out on the history of the race, says the event gained major popularity early on.
Fairbanks was a pretty small town, and there wasn't that much going on, so it became a big event that everyone wanted to participate in. And the other thing was it wasn't excluded for runners, you know, as long as you could participate and spend 10 hours or more out there. If you were willing to walk 26 miles, you were encouraged to do so. So the vast majority of the participants, 1 year, I think 1969, there were 1,160 participants, 900 of them were hikers.
The Equinox was begun by the University of Alaska Fairbanks ski team, a project Saari says was originally focused on development of a ski trail.
At that point, they didn't think that the marathon would have much lasting power. There were only about a dozen marathons in the whole country at that point, and it wasn't really a popular sport, so they sort of had ulterior motives.
Saari credits UAF ski coach Jim Mahaffey and team members Nat Goodhue and Gail Bakken and others with leading the early charge, laying out the trail that became the venue for the big fall running race. The event saw participation drop to a few hundred during the 70s and 80s, but the race has been gaining steam again in the last decade, continuing an Equinox marathon history Saari describes as colorful.
A lot of crazy things happened. I mean, Mary Shields did the whole thing with an owl on her shoulder, and 1 year, the college co-eds built a stretcher or a litter and carried a co-ed for 26 miles along the whole course. And Charlie Kegler ran the thing barefoot. And John Waterman allegedly started it wearing Speedos and a cape, the famous mountaineer John Waterman. So there's been a lot of bizarre stories, and there's going to be a chapter just of, like, weird things.
One of the most memorable stories happened at the front of the race in 1983 when Equinox record holder Stan Justice battled a locally unknown rookie who showed up and won in record time. Justice says Patrick Cross, a national-caliber college half-miler, had an amazing first-time marathon performance.
He had never run a marathon. The longest race he had ever run before was a 9-mile. But he was a missionary, and he was in Fort Yukon, and everybody up there saw how fast he was. And so they said, hey, Patrick, you should go down and run that Equinox. And so he just showed up and jumped in, and he fell down three times during the race. But boy, he'd get on the roads, and he'd be right with us again. I mean, he was just so fast on the roads that we couldn't keep up with him.
Justice went on to best Cross's Equinox record the next year, setting a new mark of 2 hours, 41 minutes that's held up ever since. Sari, whose best time is just under 2:50, says nobody since has come within 5 minutes of Justice's mark. Tomorrow's field includes Sari, who last won in 2010, and defending men's champion Matt Dunlop. 2011 women's champion and three-time Equinox winner Laura Brocious is also back. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Southeast Alaska Power Agency is seeking new ways to make hydropower more efficient and more consistent through innovative new technology. KSTK's Ann Hillman found out more about the study.
The problem with hydropower is that sometimes the water flow and the electric needs of the community don't match up. Limited water supplies produce less electricity in the winter when power loads are higher, so Southeast communities have to rely partially on more expensive diesel. In the late summer and early fall, lots of rain leads to large flows when less power is needed. The extra water is allowed to spill over the dam.
And when you spill, the water is lost and cannot be captured or used later for hydroelectric production. So we want to find a way to store up that energy so we can use it later when loads are high.
That's Eric Wolf, Director of Special Projects with Southeast Alaska Power Agency. SEPA is seeking support and funding for a feasibility study examining the potential of storing extra power from the summer for use in the winter. One option would be using the extra water that currently spills over to create electricity that could split water into hydrogen. The hydrogen is then used as a power source in the winter. Wolf says that if the project works, one benefit would be not needing to rely on diesel in the winter.
And you could effectively store energy in a different medium. Then all kinds of options open up for hydropower.
Wolf says you wouldn't have to build a dam to control and store up water to create consistent electricity. Instead, the power could be produced from the natural flow of water, then held in storage tanks until it's needed. Wolf says that eliminates the environmental problems that come with dams, like blocking fish passage.
The problem, of course, is that it has to be cost-effective and safe.
Which is where the feasibility study comes into play. The technology to store power as hydrogen or ammonia is still new. Wolf says that much of the feasibility study involves doing a literature review and looking at all of the similar setups that are currently in operation. Then, they would see how it could work in conjunction with SEPA's facilities in the Southeast. Wolf also hopes they can collaborate with universities and other power producers. And if it works, then it could be used to store power from wind and waves as well. SEPA is seeking a $245,000 grant from the Alaska Energy Authority to fund the study. I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Stephanie Joyce. This week on AK, geese. Thousands of black brants nest each spring on a piece of marshy tundra near Chivak in western Alaska. And for nearly three decades, the small geese have been the research focus of biologist Jim Settinger. In 1984, the University of Nevada, Reno professor decided the brants would be good subjects for a long-term study on a bird population. This summer, he brought an audio recorder out into the field. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
It's the middle of July. The fuzzy goslings have all hatched and are growing strong. The adult brants are in molt, and so most can't fly. And that's when biologist Jim Sedinger and his team of half a dozen grad students and technicians start rounding up the birds and dividing them into three separate pens.
Ooh, perfect. Let's get these in the right.
Hang on.
As Sedinger describes it, it's a little like herding cattle. Once the brants are contained, the team weighs each one in a plastic Folgers coffee can that rests on a small scale. They measure bill length and leg length. Then they attach two identifiable bands, one metal and one colored, to the geese's skinny legs. Sedinger calls out the new banding IDs on one of the birds.
Local male with the web tag. 5, 4, 8L.
When the banding drive, as Sedinger calls it, is over, the birds are released back into the pen they came from so they can find their mate. The work makes for long days in the field. On this day alone, the team banded and measured 1,500 brants. It was technically the next morning by the time Sedinger had a moment to record his thoughts.
It's 1 a.m. on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. We're about ready to go to bed tonight. We had a great day. We started at about 11 a.m. and finished about midnight. And everybody's tired. We're going to bed. No dinner tonight. We got another tough day tomorrow.
This summer was Sedinger's 29th field season with the Brant Study, and over the decades, his research has become one of the longest-running animal studies in the world. He began his work in 1984 as a young biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Goose populations across western Alaska were in a steep decline. In an interview after he was back at the office, Sedinger says he figured brants would make good research subjects because they nest in a tight colony.
It's relatively easy to observe lots of birds, mark lots of birds, and then collect data on those birds. So we now, over the course of this project, have banded, put metal bands and then engraved plastic bands so we can identify the birds at a distance in the neighborhood of about 40,000 individual geese.
Over the years, Sedinger and his research partners have answered lots of interesting questions about the geese, including why are the birds monogamous? But the bigger question they keep coming back to is a simple one. What makes for a successful brant? And Sedinger says that success is measured by just one thing, how many offspring a bird produces that will themselves survive to produce offspring.
We found that just as in human society, there's a lot of variation in success. So there are some pairs that are almost always successful and other pairs that typically have a tougher time in life and probably don't leave very many offspring to future generations.
The length of the study has also allowed Sedinger to look at how the birds age. Dozens of the brants he banded as goslings are now over 20 years old, and he has found that as the population numbers at the colony have decreased over the years, the average lifespan of the geese is increasing.
Something fundamental has changed in the lives of these birds that is allowing them to basically live longer.
Sedinger thinks the birds may be living longer partly because they have more space at the colony. The brant population in Sedinger's study area has declined 70% in the past three decades. Fewer geese mean less social strife and fighting, which reduces the bird's stress level. He jokes that it's as if the brants moved from Manhattan to Anchorage. Sedinger says, looking back on his work over the last three decades, it's hard for him to believe the brant study is still going.
If somebody had said to me in 1984, you'll still be out here in 2012, I would have thought they were nuts.
Sedinger is starting to think about retiring and passing the study on to a younger generation of biologists.
So we're going to start processing these birds. We expect it to be a few hours and we'll be finished. So sometime early evening. I'll check in later.
But he hopes the research will keep going long after he's banded his last brant in western Alaska. For AK, I'm Annie Feit.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week on AK, we're heading to Northway, a tiny village on the far eastern edge of interior Alaska.
I'm Lorraine Titus,
a lifelong resident of Northway, and I'm the president of the Northway Natives Incorporated. You have to cross the Shoshana River, then you get to the village, and the village is right along the Nabisna. So when the Shoshana and Nabisna come together, it forms the beginning of the Tanana River. My grandpa, who was Chief Northway, Walter Northway, lived to be 117. There's about probably close to about 250 people. It's really spread out. And then on the Northway Road is our school, which at this time we have 39 students. Not much jobs here. The corporation probably employs about 12 people, and the school, besides the teachers, local people, there's probably about 5 people there, and we have the post office. And the village council, you know, has a lot of employees over there. Pretty much keep to themselves. They do try to set up some gathering. Like in the summertime, we do culture camps. You know, the local people get together, and we have a culture camp up the river, and we haul people in. Right now, everybody's out moose hunting, by boats, by vehicles, you know, camping out and going to moose camps, and everybody's, you know, out moose hunting. So we're just busy. It's beautiful. I love it. I'm still here.
That was Lorraine Titus of Northway, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Wrangell. Stephanie Joyce was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the solutions to help Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.